Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM.
Hello, welcome to Alaska Edition. I'm Jill Burke, filling in for Michael Carey. Joining us today are Kyle Hopkins with the Anchorage Daily News and Steve McDonald, news director at KTUU Channel 2. Steve, we'll start with you. Finally, after about a month, it looks like the legislature is finally ready to deal with the governor's budget or the budget proposals that they respectively have. So where are we at this point, and what finally happened to shake the gridlock loose?
The gridlock mainly was over the capital budget. The Senate had cobbled together like a $2.8, $2.9 billion spending plan for capital projects. And in that budget was some language that was an all or nothing at all approach towards energy projects, that if the governor vetoed one project, he had to veto them all. Of course, the Senate wanted to keep all of the energy projects alive inside the budget. The House objected to this, the governor objected to this, and that's what basically started the standoff. Now, over the week, the House finally got its hands on the capital budget, added some money to it. It now stands at about $3.1 billion. They've stripped the language out of there, that all or nothing at all veto language that the Senate had put in there. Now the question is whether or not Senate leaders are going to ask for a conference committee to iron out the differences between the House version and the Senate version. If the leadership in the Senate says, no, we're just going to let it stand as is, the session could come to an end either today, tonight, or Friday night, as we tape on a Friday, or over the weekend.
And the special session's due to end on Tuesday.
Correct. And then they'll have to decide whether or not they want another 30 days or maybe a cooling off period, come back later on, what have you. But it sounds like it's coming to an end right now. I haven't seen anything that really would blow this thing up at this point.
Okay, the end is near.
Perhaps.
So one item that's come up is that one of the things that's happening is both the governor and the lieutenant governor are up for a pay raise. And I guess the question is, should they get them, and why now? What's prompting this adjustment?
Yeah, well, I guess it's been a committee that's been formed, and you know, there are various committees that compare private sector salaries to public sector salaries, and are we keeping up people being paid properly, that type of thing. There's been over the years a lot of talk and speculation about whether or not the governor, lieutenant governor, legislators, for that matter, too, are paid enough for the jobs that they do, you know, and there's been a recent recommendation that I think what would be considered modest pay raises for the governor and the lieutenant governor. Now, whether the governor or lieutenant governor would accept them, in the past there's been leadership that said, no, I'm not going to accept the raise, but you know, that there's been a recommendation anyways for, I think, $15,000 a year increase for the lieutenant governor, and I think it's maybe around $20,000, $25,000 for the governor. So,
So the Compensation Commission, which I think is the thing that Mike Dugan called for years ago, initially, like in November, suggested that the governor go from making $125,000 to $175,000, and then that's since been dialed back to now he would make $145,000. Mm-hmm. And there was a public hearing that no one went to, apparently, just like no one went to it when there was a public hearing on increasing legislators' pay. You know, I think we think that people are going to get all fired up about this, but not enough to actually go to these hearings and kind of rattle their fists.
So is this the general public is not paying attention, or the general public doesn't care? Should they be paying more attention than they do, or is this we trust that things are happening accurate, you know, the way they should?
Well, who knows? I mean, you know, maybe they don't know that these hearings are going on. You know, maybe we're not doing a good enough job telling them that it's going to happen. Yeah. Maybe we just kind of assume that it's going to be a big deal and it's not. But so it'd be a $20,000 raise for Parnell, right? And I think he's indicated through his spokeswoman that he feels like it's appropriate, right? As opposed to Palin, who, remember, Palin was going to get, she was going to get $150,000 a year, and she said that she would not accept it, and it just kind of faded away.
Right.
I'm a little confused about this process because, my understanding is that the commission suggests it, and that unless the legislature moves to kind of strike it, it just happens. So, you know, it's kind of being portrayed as something that's in the House bill. But that kind of doesn't make sense to me. Like, why would it need to be? Why would there need to be money in the capital budget specifically for that?
You would think it would be in the operating budget, if anything, right? And it is political dynamite in a lot of ways. When you look at what went on in Wisconsin here recently, went on in Ohio, where the governor there basically declared war on union workers and demanded rollbacks and some of the compensation packages that they got. One of the first targets when things get tight in a state or a city, the first targets seem to be pay for, or even the labor force, the workforce in the public or in the government sector. So it's this could be political dynamite. You accept that money, you accept that pay raise, and maybe a year or two from now, you're going back to the union saying, okay, I need a little bit back from you. Well, you took that $20,000 pay raise, so yeah, it could be a slippery slope there. Do they deserve it? I think if a bipartisan committee said, yeah, they do. And we all know the governor works pretty hard, as does the lieutenant governor. They do a lot. They're always on the clock, So they probably do deserve a pay raise. But yeah, it is politically. It could be dynamite later on.
Yeah, I think the committee's argument was that you have like 300 people who work for the state, right, yeah. And make more money than the governor, and is that appropriate, and how much do other governors make? But their initial recommendation was pretty generous. It would have made Alaska's governor like in the top 10, 15% of all governors, for a state without a lot of people.
So. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to switch topics here because we have a lot to move through. Yeah. So I'll toss to Kyle here again. Talk about the Palin emails. A former aide to Governor Sarah Palin has a tell-all book coming out that relies in large part on emails that he accumulated during his tenure with him. During his tenure with her. As we all know, Palin-era emails are a hot commodity. The press has been after these for a long, long time. We have a big dump that's expected to be released from the state due out later this month. Meanwhile, Frank Bailey, that aide, has fallen under scrutiny for his use of such emails. And so what is going on with him? What's the situation?
Well, I'll try and keep this as simple as I can. my understanding, I edited the story, didn't write it. My understanding is Andre McLeod, who, as you could describe as kind of a political activist who has, been a kind of a watchdog for the Palin administration, had filed an ethics complaint saying that Bailey shouldn't be able to make money off this book using emails that she says should be public record, right? Emails from Sarah Palin about government business. And then it gets tricky because, did she write those on her Yahoo account? And are those public emails? Are those subject to a public records request? Should we be able to get those? And if we shouldn't be able to get those, should Bailey be able to put them in his book and then sell his book, right? And so I think what triggered a story this week was that Andre McLeod got a letter back from the State Department of Law saying, look, we are looking into this. Mm-hmm. We're looking at it. We're investigating. We're also looking to see, we have like our IT guys, doing something to see if there are emails that are missing, that maybe these are the emails that he has but and should be in the state's possession but aren't. But there's a lot of unanswered questions. And Bailey, what emails exactly are in that book and what emails are we talking about? And I don't know that we have the best understanding of that.
Right. And we had, just as an example, when former U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller had departed his job of employment at the Fairbanks North Star Borough and had emails that they didn't know may or may not have been in their position, they forced him, they compelled him to hand them back over so that they could review and feel like their record was complete. So a slightly different situation, but kind of similar topic. And it's squirrely, it's hard to stay on top of, especially if you're a member of the public.
Yeah, we should note that Bailey's lawyer said that, these are, they're working with the Department of Law, I think, and they don't feel like, they feel like the emails that are in the book are not subject to public records requests. And I think they're also arguing that the emails themselves are not inherently valuable, that it's Bailey's like recollections that are valuable.
And I think they said they published them within the boundaries of what's in concert with the law, that he didn't do anything wrong. So we'll see. The Arctic Council, switching topics here just again. Mm-hmm. In Greenland, the Arctic nations met to talk about a lot of different issues. They signed an historic agreement that has to do with search and rescue. And Steve, why is that so significant?
Well, there wasn't any real agreement or any real plan up until now. If an airplane flying over the pole were to crash into the Arctic Ocean, you know, who would be responsible for trying to rescue the folks? And I think it's a peace of mind for everybody who travels through the area, whether it's on a ship or whether you're an aircraft flying over the area, to know that there are eight countries in agreement that they have a plan to come to the rescue of somebody who may be in peril. This is an area that's going to see a lot more traffic over the years because of climate change. We're seeing a lot more boats come through, the ships come through there. There's talk of obviously building deep water ports. There's also a lot of talk about oil exploration further and further out into the sea. So this may be the first step. Okay, you're talking about search and rescue. Perhaps you're also talking about environmental protections in the Arctic. And should there be a well blowout and there's an oil spill, something to the effect of what happened in the Gulf of Mexico a year ago, you would have that in place at some particular point in time in terms of who would respond and who would clean that up and contain it. But this is dealing just with the search and rescue aspect of it. It is an area that's going to see a lot more traffic as the years go by.
So is the thinking that because these nations have managed to come to a binding agreement with respect to search and rescue, that it then lays the blueprint for foundations in these other realms that you've suggested, whether it's responding to oil spills or whether it's dealing with shipping traffic or, I mean, you've got a lot of international traffic coming through, you've got international boundaries.
Right.
You know, how do you manage all of those protocols? And then Arctic, which everybody's very, very interested in, not just because of its wealth, but because of its, you know, the marine life, the ecosystem, mm-hmm. the indigenous cultures.
I don't know what folks have, what the various governments have planned by any stretch. I know you've got a lot of eyeballs on that area right now. You've got various countries claiming ocean bottom as theirs and other countries saying, well, wait, your boundaries are extending way too far out into the ocean. So that certainly is a debate among various countries. This perhaps is a first step towards negotiating some of those other issues away, but you know, this is like I said, I think perhaps it's just the first step.
And the treaty did include very strong language with respect to the effects of climate change, managing them. Mm-hmm. They weren't binding, but it used words like "we urge action on this," "we recognize this is taking place." I think again, reinforcing this foundation that's been laid to go on and continue to have these conversations and maybe pave the way for future discussions.
Every single one of these countries that's involved in this, they're just like Alaska. They're all being affected by climate change. Polar bears pretty much are on their frontier, on their doorsteps, and we all know what's going on with polar bear habitat. That ecosystem is changing. It's changing by the month, pretty much. And so everybody has a stake in that, and it's good to see these countries, with this type of cooperation. And again, it may not go any further than what they've just done here with search and rescue, but then again, it may be a really good first step. And the fact that they're talking about that's in the dialogue, I think that's probably good news for folks keeping an eye on this region.
And we should mention that Senator Lisa Murkowski and Lieutenant Governor Mead Tredwell were both in attendance in Greenland and participated in those, and we've heard from them a little bit in response to that. This week also we've learned in the Arctic that Shell Exploration has applied for additional or new exploratory permits in the Chukchi Sea, which is in supplement to those that they already are pursuing in the Beaufort Sea. And I guess the question is the political climate easing up to see these projects go through? They have complained in the past that they were shut down last year, that they don't have certainty with this year. Kyle.
Well, I could say about that is, I mean, certainly gas prices help put the pressure on, right? You know, before I ran out here, I noticed the Associated Press moved a story about, the EPA's clean air chief being in front of Congress and kind of being prodded, you know, why haven't permits been granted? And I think she said that they were close to granting three exploratory drilling permits in the Arctic Ocean, and that's kind of the sum total of what I know about that. But it doesn't hurt to have stories every day about the price of gas, and you've got to imagine that's kind of lights that puts pressure on EPA.
Mm-hmm. Steve, any insight on that particular topic?
You also saw the heads of the major oil companies go before a congressional hearing earlier this week and say the same thing. We need to have more domestic exploratory drilling and production, and that would help ease the price of gasoline. They were hauled before Congress to say, how come gas prices are so high? Well, they're saying, well, it's not up to us. We don't do that. It's the market that sets that, and we don't really set the price of gasoline. But you know, if there's more product, if there's more oil on the market, then one would think that prices may come down to meet that demand. But
and interestingly, that conversation is happening at the same time that discussion is underway about whether or not to roll back some of the tax breaks that they have received to promote their U.S. development for hydrocarbon exploration and production. Mm-hmm. I think it was in the $4 billion. Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think that's the number that's standing out to me that they've received in order to go and pursue their projects, and when the average consumer is facing $4.20, $0.30, $0.40 per gallon to fuel their cars, and certainly in Alaska it can be much higher depending on how remote you are. That's an interesting juxtaposition.
We had at Channel 2, we don't have an editorial board, but we kind of have this group that we kind of call ourselves an editorial board. But every once in a while, we'll invite a newsmaker. We try to do it about once a month, come into the newsroom and just off the record, on background, tell us what's going on. And we recently had Lisa Murkowski, Senator Murkowski, come in. And she strongly alluded to the fact that keep an eye on ANWR. I think that sometime in the next so many months, she may introduce legislation that would attempt to open up ANWR. You know, it's a hardy perennial, as Michael Carey likes to call them. Mm-hmm. So ANWR may even surface again here very, very soon. And I don't know exactly what form that bill would take. She told us that on air as well about that she may introduce legislation regarding opening it up.
Okay.
It feels like you've got high gas prices, so you got all this pressure on people to kind of make big policy gestures that are kind of aimed at, you know, producing more oil or, you know, putting the screws to the oil companies, right? And so, in the next, 3 months, you'd think you'd see a lot of that.
One of the things that the senator told us is that she had recently seen a public opinion poll, a nationwide poll, and I don't know. She didn't tell me who did it, who did the poll, so I don't know any of the specifics, how many people were questioned, who did the poll, you know. But she did say for the first time she had seen public opinion favoring oil exploration in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Now, I have seen plenty of polls in the past over the last, say, 10 years. And, it got to the point where it was close, you know, during certain surges in oil prices and gas prices, or maybe periods of unrest in the Middle East, you know, where it would be maybe 42 or 43% of the folks were in favor of it and the rest against it. But she said this time, for the first time, she had seen a majority of Americans in favor of oil drilling.
Okay.
So things may be changing on the public front, too.
Speaking of pressure, the rivers are under a lot of pressure as we enter breakup right now. And we have seen some flooding on the Kuskokwim River. In fact, we had a village, Crooked Creek, that had to be evacuated earlier this week. Kyle, I know that you're familiar with some of what took place. What did we see there? How bad was it? And they took shelter in what might seem to some as an unusual location, but one that was close by.
Yeah, I guess they on Sunday night, the river was rising. By Monday morning, the village council president was on the phone with Donlin Creek Mine saying, hey, we have a problem. And so I guess the mine, which is like 10 miles away, has a R-44 helicopter that just only holds a few people. So just all day long was just kind of ferrying people back and forth, so that by the end of the day, you have like 50 people at the mine, lodging or whatever. And then meantime, another half or two-thirds of the village had kind of like was spread out in these little islands, right? Like the school was an island, and it's kind of secluded from another part, like the uptown village or whatever, and then another part. So people just kind of hanging out, you know, on high ground and waiting for help. And we talked to the the folks in the mine, right? And so you hear reports of, you know, like houses floating, people being woken up like as they're asleep in their house, which is like, you know, floating in the mm-hmm. river and stuff. And then meantime, back at the village, you know, the phones are down, but they have a generator at the school. So I was on Facebook with the like lead teacher there who mm-hmm. said people were doing all right. You know, they said the helicopter was coming from the mine routinely bringing supplies and food and stuff. And so, I mean, as in terms of safety, it seems like everyone was okay. But, you know, just like when you reported on Eagle a couple of years ago, right? Like, now what?
Right.
There's a lot of work to be done now.
And we should explain, these are ice-clogged rivers. These are very big, very powerful rivers that are breaking up. The ice is causing jams. It generally bends in the river. The water backs up. That's what flows into these communities. And then when the water gives or those jams break up, all of that goes surging downstream towards the communities right. below. And so I think that they were watching Aniak for a while, and the water was starting to recede. But this particular flood in Crooked Creek, locals had said it was the largest one in their lifetime memory, and I think it was measured at, what, a 30-foot
30-foot increase. I mean, don't you get the sense that it's just kind of, so every year there's breakup. I mean, the ice has got to break up on the river every year, and you kind of get the sense that it's just, you know, are you unlucky enough that the ice jam is going to happen? Mm-hmm. You know, at the point along the river that you that all that water is gonna right. you know rise in your village, and you know, like 2 years ago, Eagle and other villages, and this year is Crooked Creek that got hammered.
Right, and the Yukon appears to be breaking up much more calmly this year mm-hmm. than it has in past years. So far, they've started upriver. They'll continue watching it. You know, the middle river section, then the lower river section, and I know that water was starting to recede in Crooked Creek. I haven't heard whether that jam broke and has released, yeah, or if they're still watching it.
I saw a report that it broke. Yesterday it hadn't, but I mm-hmm. like saw a report this morning
that it did.
I think it was moving it anyways, at the very least, yeah. Yeah. And the water certainly was down 8 to 10 feet, I think, as of, again, this Friday afternoon.
Okay.
Yeah. So things seem to be improving a little bit.
Thanks. So I want to leave one more time for our final topic here, which is city living. And in Anchorage, particularly with the return of summer season and spring season, we start to see these kind of quality of life issues rise up. Bikes and vehicles and people in camps and parks and the nearby neighborhoods, homeless camps. And I guess the question is, can't everybody just get along? What is the problem? This is an annual ritual, it seems to be.
The answer is no. The answer to that question is no, they cannot.
No loving of thy neighbor.
No, you've got kind of two, I don't want to say like culture wars, but like you've got the bikes versus the, you've got the cyclists versus the drivers, right? And that seems like an evergreen.
Oh, yeah.
You know, people are, and like personally, like I can, like, you, if you ride a bike, you drive a car, you're on both sides of that yourself. Like mm-hmm. when I'm in the car and there's like a cyclist in front of you and you're kind of, you want to get around them and stuff, you get kind of frustrated. And then when you're on the bike, you totally feel like you should own the road and stuff. And so I totally get that collision. But, you know, we had like a couple tragic, you
people
know, accidents.
Died.
People died within, you know, two people within a month have died, you know, car versus cyclist collisions. And I think in both those cases, the police are faulting the cyclist, mm-hmm. right? It seems,
yes.
but certainly for the cycling community, it's you know, they're concerned that people just aren't kind of keeping an eye out for them, and meantime, I think trying to get the message out to, you know, people who are biking to kind of be a little bit more safer and stuff. But I know whenever we write about these stories, I mean, you immediately get this just kind of wave of backlash from both sides. The cyclists feel kind of, you know. Defensive, you know. Meantime, the drivers are just kind of angry at people on. You know, there's like all this anger from people on the road at cyclists. It seems to come up every single year.
True. Yeah.
Well,
I also think it's sort of like one of those. You get there's a period of adjustment. You know, when we get our first snowfall and the streets get coated with ice, you've got 150 people who just dive into ditches. It's like, oh gosh, I forgot. It's been 4 or 5 months since we've had snow. I've completely forgot how to drive on this stuff. I'll get my snow tires on, and then you don't see that every day, right? I think all of a sudden people are driving down there on those first nice days of spring, and somebody comes by on a bike. And you're just not used to seeing them. Maybe there's an adjustment period. At least I hope. Hopefully we've adjusted and this won't happen anymore. But yeah, there's got to be, people have to be aware. You know, we do have motorcycles in this town. We have bikes in this town. We have people walking on the street. Got to be careful. And there's sidewalks everywhere.
Quickly,
either.
And then I want to switch to the homeless issue.
Okay, real quickly. I also think there's not a lot of understanding about what the rules are Mm-hmm. Like when you get on your bike and then you go on the road, like where are you supposed to be?
Right.
You know, and even like I did a, you know, a bike to work story not too long ago where, you know, I'm biking with somebody going to like ConocoPhillips or something. The police were like trying to get us off the road onto the sidewalk and stuff. And that's like, that's not the law. I mean, even the police officers, I think, are a little bit,
yeah,
at least at the time, were kind of a little unclear as to where you're supposed to be when you're on the bicycle. Yeah.
Okay. So let's, I'm just going to switch topics
because
we're going to run
ahead.
Out of time. I'm sorry, yeah. Steve, you're cut off. The parks, you know, in terms of ownership of them and who has a right to utilize them, this issue of homeless camps is a big issue. They can be unsightly, they can be unclean. Some people will argue that they have a right to be there, that it's a public space, that there's not enough low-income housing. And meanwhile, you've got neighborhoods who may attach to these camps some blights that they just don't want to be dealing with. They want a nice walkable neighborhood. They want a nice walkable park for their family, for their children. How do you, what's the answer? Kyle Hopkins, what is the answer?
And you've got 56 seconds to do it. Come on, buddy.
Again, I'll just say that we, you know, our columnist, Julie O'Malley, wrote a column mm-hmm. about this week, mm-hmm. and she wrote that just kind of expressing her frustration at, you know, having her lawn chairs disappear or looking across, like literally like looking across the road and seeing a tent, you know, just kind of tents and people kind of going about their business.
Or
maybe they're going to the bathroom.
People using the restroom,
right.
not the restroom.
Right, and just being a little fed up with kind of that being permissible, you know, in the city, like in a public park right across, like in your neighborhood. And is that, what do you do about that?
Okay, well, I guess we'll have to wait until the next edition of Alaska mm-hmm. Edition to find out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you again.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.